had that three or four times.
Call the House Committee on Judiciary to order Tuesday, May 24th, 2011. Couple of announcements. We got notice of possible bill introduction tomorrow of LC 4213. I'll give you a list of bills we're not going to hear today. Senate Bill 67. That bill probably will not be heard any further this session in any form for anybody. 347 is going to be brought forward with an amendment that's coming. And we won't be doing 405A. And 592, we will work if we get the amendment, otherwise it'll be carried over along with 405A tomorrow. Okay, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 356A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 356A comes to you from the Department of Corrections, eliminates the Department of Corrections pilot program involving the treatment of sex offenders with the hormone, basically Depo-Provera. You may remember the testimony concerning the difficulty and the impossibility of getting anyone to provide the treatment and the potential liability issues around this, too, Mr. Chair.
Just don't leave. I'm going to vote on it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 356A to the floor to be passed. Chair Barker moves Senate Bill 356A to the floor to be passed. Any discussion on the bill? Call the roll.
Representative
Bowen.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Excuse
me. Representative
Stoplin.
Aye.
Representative Cummings.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Lizard.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Harris.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Harris.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair
Barker.
Aye.
Senate Bill 356A goes to the floor to pass. Anybody like to carry it?
Okay.
Representative Wong. Do we have any legislators here on the bill that are hiding anywhere? Not yet. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 496.
Thanks, Mike.
Staff is on the run.
Appreciate your patience. Chair and members of the committee, appreciate your patience. Senate Bill 496A clarifies court's authority to stay sentencing orders in whole or in part pending the outcome of the case on appeal. It requires courts to consider certain factors upon the request for stay, and requires court to order certain conditions of release if granted.
We have Jesse Barton and Gail come up, please.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Krieger and Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Here in support on behalf of Senate Bill 496, I just communicated with Senator Bonamici's staff. Senator Bonamici would want to be here. This is a bill she submitted, but she's involved in some redistricting meetings right now and cannot attend. I will leave the heavy lift here and the explanation for the provisions of this to Jess Barton, who is with me to my right. He is the appellate guru amongst us. But essentially, this is a codification of existing authority, and it clarifies existing authority. What does happen right now is trial courts do have the authority to stay a portion of the sentence, but it's unclear when the parties actually read the statute. And so at the impetus of Senator Bonamici, we actually had a work group. We sat down with members of the Appellate Division of DOJ, and the courts were there, as well as lawyers from the Public Defender Services Commission and Jess Barton, and we came to this agreed language, and I'll let Mr. Barton explain it to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, actually what Ms. Meyer said is correct. This bill basically just clarifies existing authority and creates a more comprehensible authority for allowing these stays of sentences pending appeal. Courts have that authority now. They always have had that authority, but it's, you know, the statutes that authorize it are a real mismatch. And under Senate Bill 486, that would be eliminated. Instead, there'd be the mismatch of statutory authority would be replaced with something, like I say, more comprehensible. I did want to mention one thing, though, and that is that the this bill actually does, in one way, restricts trial court authority to stay sentences pending appeal in comparison to what trial courts now have. Right now, a trial court could authorize issue an order staying a sentence pending appeal at any particular time during the course of an appeal. And what this, what the amendments do, or what the A and Gross version of the bill does, is say that, well, no, the a motion for a stay order, a motion for an order staying a sentence pending appeal, must be filed by the time of the by the time that the appeal itself is filed. So once the appeal has been filed, the trial court would lose its authority to issue one of these orders, unless good cause is shown for a motion to be filed in order to be issued after the appeal has been filed. And the bill doesn't define good cause, but I've provided in my written material some examples of what we believe, what our work group believe would satisfy the good cause requirement for a court to be able to issue an order subsequent to the filing of the appeal. Another point I want to clarify, and that's that an order authorizing a stay of sentence pending appeal does not itself release anybody from prison. For example, a court would never issue an order saying release defendant so-and-so from prison forthwith. It would never say that. What the order would say is that the defendant may be released pending appeal under the following conditions. And the conditions would be probably really similar. It probably would mirror the conditions that the defendant's pretrial bail release was allowed under. So if the defendant can meet those conditions that the trial court imposes, then the defendant would be released. So the order just authorizes the release to occur in the event that the defendant meets the conditions that the court imposes. And that's pretty much summarizes or wraps up what I have to say. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Is the existing authority statutory, rule-based, case law? Where is it found?
Co-Chairs, Representative Hicks, it's statutory-based solely. Not constitutionally based, by the way. I have actually cited a case in my written materials explaining there's no constitutional right to one of these. As there is, say, a pretrial bail release, you have a constitutional right to that. Stay pending appeal, there's no constitutional right. It's statutory, so only.
Anyone else have any questions on the bill?
Yeah.
Is one?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So how long does one of these criminal appeals usually take?
Co-Chair, Representative Wand, an appeal could take, actually I'm working on a case right now that was recently sent back after a guy winning an appeal. The appeal itself took about 3 years. So I tell people when clients come into my office and they want to do an appeal, they ask, how long will it take for my appeal? How long will my appeal take? And it's, I say, 1.5 to 2 years, but it could be longer. 3 years is not that unusual.
Well, so let's say a criminal defendant is sentenced to 9 months and they appeal. Under current law, they stay in jail for 3 years?
No, it wouldn't happen like that. I'm sorry, Co-Chair, Representative Juan. No, if he's got a 9-month sentence, his appeal goes up, and they say the appeal takes 2 or 3 years, and in the end, he may win it. After 2 or 3 years, he'll have won the appeal, but he'll have served out that 9-month sentence and will have been released after finishing the 9-month sentence under your hypothetical. And then he would go on to something called post-prison supervision if it's a felony case, which is something like parole. And if he wins his appeal, then perhaps he would be released from post-prison supervision. He wouldn't have to complete that term. But he will have completed the prison term before he won his appeal. That happens pretty frequently.
One last One last follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So I take it if we had another three or four Court of Appeals judges, then the amount of time for these appeals to get resolved might be reduced, and the length of time that these people are on kind of supervision would go down as well.
Co-Chairs, Representative Wand, I believe that's true. I mean, I'm personally an advocate of expanding the size of the Court of Appeals. It hasn't been expanded since 1977 or something like that. The state's population is, I don't know, double or something since then. But in any event, if the Court of Appeals, I know there is a push to expand the size by, what, three judges or something like that, and presumably that would shorten every judge's caseload by that percentage of additional new judges, and hopefully would shorten the time it takes to get decisions out of the Court of Appeals. Right now, I'm going to just talk a little bit about, if it's okay, chairs would permit me, that if once the briefs have been filed in an appeal, case is said to be at issue, a party might not get even oral arguments for 5 or 6 months after the briefs have been filed. So you sit there waiting just to get oral arguments in a case, and then finally you get oral arguments, and then you wait on the opinion from the Court of Appeals, and that could be a great length of time. I have a case right now that's been under advisement for 14 months.
Thank you.
And to confirm, so the time during which the sentence is stayed, post-sentencing, pending appeal, does not count toward the sentence, right?
Co-Chairs, Representative Hicks, that is correct.
Okay.
No credit for time served if your sentence has been stayed pending appeal.
Thank you.
Anything further? Okay, we do have the co-chair of Ways and Means Public Safety sitting over here, don't we? And you are aware of the need of the courts and judges, and you're doing your best.
I'm doing my best, and it's failing miserably.
It's difficult, isn't it?
Yes.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 496 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 557.
Mr. Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 557A requires district attorney of each county to organize sexual assault response teams, or SARTs, requires each SART to adopt protocols addressing sexual assault response, requires certain health facilities to adopt policies for treatment of acute sexual assault patients, requires certain health care facilities that perform forensic medical examinations of sexual assault patients to adopt guidelines developed by Sexual Assault Task Force, and to employ or contract with sexual assault forensic examiner trained to satisfy certification requirements of the Oregon Sex Assault Examiner or Sex Assault Nurse Examiner Certification Commission, allows for adoption of protocols specific to child victims developed pursuant to ORS 418-747, and modifies requirements to accommodate facilities that conduct forensics exams and treat only child victims of sexual assault, declares an emergency is effective on passage. Current law does not require that these teams be organized specifically to respond to reports of sexual assault, nor that they adopt uniform standards, but such teams have developed over time, it's my understanding, due to the intimate nature of these kind of crimes. The influence of best practices with regard to evidence collection and the particular needs of vulnerable victims. The vast majority of Oregon's counties already have developed SARTs without being required to do so, and this measure directs the remaining counties to do the same, locating organizational responsibility with each district attorney's office and providing for greater consistency between them with regard to the adoption of more standardized investigation and treatment protocols.
Did you jump up? Are you going to identify yourself?
I did, Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Hoyt. I'm the legislative aide to Senator Chris Edwards. Senator Edwards and Representative Matthews are here to testify as well. They're on their way from committee, so hopefully they'll be here momentarily. Cheyenne did a very good job introducing the bill. Senate Bill 557 is basically broken into two sections, and it was a response that our office did. After being contacted by some constituents in our area wondering why there wasn't a formalized response to sexual assault down in Lane County. Section 1 of the bill deals with the actual formation of the sexual assault response team. It charges the district attorney of each county with centralizing a SART within their office, asks that a member of the VAP, the Victims Assistance Program, from that office participate, as well as local law enforcement, a SANE trained nurse, and a member of the local advocacy team. It says that by 2012, The SART shall adopt protocols for the function within their county. Those protocols can be county specific. We've worked very hard in drafting the language on the bill to make sure that we're not having, a mandate on a county that their protocols have to look a certain way. We understand that each county is different and each protocol will be different. It says that the SARTs have to meet at least quarterly, and that basically sums up Section 1 of the bill. Section 2 of the bill deals with the acute medical response to sexual assault that a victim may face in their area. We define a medical facility in the bill, and so I'll just go ahead and skip over that because I'm sure you've all read it. But basically it says that if you are a medical facility as defined in this bill, by 2012 or 2013, depending on the size of the county in which your facility is located, if you provide forensic medical examinations, you have to, at minimum, adopt the Attorney General's guidelines for forensic medical examination. And then also, by 2012 or 2013, employer contract with at least one sane, trained nurse for your facility. If you do not provide the examinations, all we're asking in this bill is that your facility adopt protocols to transfer that victim to a facility that does. Again, there's no known opposition to the bill. Our office has worked very hard with stakeholders over the interim to draft it, and I'd make myself available to any questions the committee might have.
Any members, do you have any questions? Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you.
Sarah Hoyt, Christine Herman, and Liz Jacobson. Patrick Moore here. You might as well come up too.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Christine Herman, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Sexual Assault Task Force here in support of Senate Bill 557. I want to thank Senator Edwards and his staff, Sarah Hoyt in particular, for the work they've done on this really important bill. Sexual assault response teams are a community-based response to sexual assault and are recognized as best practice in recognized by the International Association of Chiefs of Police, recognized by the International Association of Forensic Nurses, and by advocates and prosecutors nationwide. A sexual assault response team has four primary members: a prosecutor, an advocate, a sexual assault nurse examiner or other medical provider, and a police officer. Most SARTs also have additional members: mental health providers, members from the school, members from campuses in the community, et cetera. But the point of a SART is to support the victim-centered approach to these crimes. So we support a victim who uses the criminal justice system in an effort to make that crime one that can be handled in the criminal justice system. And the biggest determinant of whether a victim is able to follow through with the criminal justice system is whether she has support from the beginning. The bill would move Oregon forward in a really important place, and as I think you heard already, the majority of counties already have a SART. It's a membership group that's developed organically because of the importance of this issue. I have, and you will be receiving, letters of support from around the state that indicate that these sorts of efforts can happen in all different communities. We have a letter from Mike Schrunk, the district attorney in Multnomah County, which has a very well-established SART. But you also have a letter from Josephine County, a very small county in southwest Oregon, that also has a SART. And each of those counties will handle things differently, but they have the same purpose, which is to support the victim through the criminal justice system. I'm here to answer any questions that you have, and thank you for considering this bill.
Thank you, Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, and members of the committee. My name is Liz Jacobson, and I'm an advocate from the Sexual Assault Resource Center in Washington County, and I'm also a member of the Washington County SART team, and I'm here in support of Bill 557. Sexual assault is a community-based problem that necessitates a community-based response. SART teams formalize this response, which facilitates more thorough investigations, better victim support, and greater offender accountability.
The Washington County SART currently uses a team approach to inform our work at every stage of the criminal justice process and hold each other accountable for fair and respectful treatment of trauma victims. Our collaborative efforts minimize the additional trauma a survivor can experience in the aftermath of an assault. If every county in Oregon had a SART, any survivor of sexual assault, regardless of where the assault occurred, could be assured with the same coordinated, effective response from professionals who have adopted a victim-centered and trauma-informed philosophy. In my role as an advocate, I would not be able to provide the service as effectively without our Washington County SART. Advocates are essential to a survivor's overall experience with the criminal justice system. A survivor's satisfaction with the process is ultimately tied to his or her connection with an advocate, because an advocate is the access point to every other part of the system. As advocates, we navigate the entire process with a victim and facilitate interactions with every other member of the team. We cannot operate in isolation. If we do not have solid working relationships with each of our professional partners, we are not able to serve our purpose. Furthermore, without collaboration between advocates and other responders, survivors feel unsupported, frustrated, and they will often decide to drop out of the system altogether. As a member of the Washington County SART, I have personal connections with sexual assault nurse examiners, the head of community corrections, advocates and prosecutors at the district attorney's office, and detectives at each of our county's law enforcement agencies. No matter where a survivor is reporting or what questions they have, I know who to call to get answers. I don't waste time waiting through phone trees and answering machines to get in touch with a person who knows me and trusts what I'm doing and wants to help. Furthermore, I know the person I call will share a common language. I trust that every SART member I contact has a common goal with me, which is to treat a victim with dignity. But we also understand that our roles are different, and a deeper understanding of these differences leads to a more seamless response. We know what our professional barriers are going to be, which allows us to strategize solutions for communication ahead of time and work together as allies. The SART gives us a roadmap for interacting with each other and trusting the work that everyone is doing on the team. SARTs not only allow sexual assault professionals to form one-on-one relationships, but also to form a collaborative synergy. Although forming a SART takes energy and commitment, Senate Bill 557 will benefit every member of the community, as every one of us lives in a culture where sexual violence happens every day.
Thank you. Chairman Krieger, Chairman Barker, Vice Chairs and Committee Members, my name is Patrick Moore. I'm a lieutenant with the Roseburg Police Department in Douglas County. And as Christine and Liz have expertly summarized the benefits, of a SART, I just want to take a couple minutes and tell a success story from rural Oregon and having a SART for 9 years now. The initial benefits inherent in the bill are, of course, taking at least four, more like six or seven professions that historically did not always work well together simply because they did not always understand one another's roles. Putting them on a committee together with just periodic meetings, asking them to build policy which respects all the parallel avenues of the investigation of sexual assault, which unfortunately, as a dynamic, especially in the criminal justice system, is not a priority at the administrative levels of most agencies or institutions. Once those policies are built, and obviously cooperation being bred from familiarization, one of the things that, as many members of this committee are already familiar with, emergency medicine in particular and law enforcement as well, share a couple of characteristics other than shift work and, you know, working weekends and nights, is that they're professionals are jacks of many trades, but experts of very few. Sexual assault is one area in which in most of those professions, it's a higher level of expertise that not many people possess. So getting those people in the room to build a policy achieves consistency across the board. Prior to those, what you would see would be a victim's treatment or a client's treatment would be based on what day of the week or what hour of the day they would present to a medical facility, to a law enforcement agency. Those policies achieve that. And as community council addressed already, Section 1 of the bill, of course, has no cost component to it. It's just people who are already working in those fields getting together and building that policy. And within Section 2, the cost is not only nominal, but a formed SART defrays that cost even more. And other than that, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee thinks I might be able to address.
Committee members, any questions of the witnesses? Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Matthews, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Krieger and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Matthews, State Representative for House District 50. It is the great city of Gresham. Proud to be here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 557. I just want to talk just briefly and put some comments on the record that I think are very pertinent to this bill. My experience in the past, I'm a firefighter now, but I was currently, or in the past, a police officer. I think back to years ago, and some of you on the committee had this experience as well, the way that we used to handle child abuse cases. And I think about how we used to do those, and they were independent investigations based on the officer themselves and the agency in which it was handling them, and there wasn't much coordination. And then along came this concept of child abuse team, the CAT team. Now, I can for one tell you that a dear friend of mine served on the CAT team for a number of years. In fact, several friends have. And it's not a job particularly that I would want to do. But what an important role it is to make sure that you're handling situations consistently, accurately, and you're coordinating that response so that those children don't have to relive that response each and every time they're talked to somebody different. Now turning the page forward to today's world, sexual abuse response teams. These are good in Multnomah County. Unfortunately, we have a need for it. Let's face it, crimes are more violent, and this world has become more violent. I'm deathly afraid having three little girls, 10, 7, and 4. My daughter's on an overnight field trip as I sit here today, but she's with my wife as a chaperone. I just don't trust this world we live in. And if something should happen to my family that I cannot prevent personally, I want to at least make sure that we have a well-deployed scenario where people are out there that are actually using this coordinated effort, and they're doing a systematic approach, and they're solving the problem. This is about being a victim's advocate for me. This is about the law enforcement background of mine. This is about hoping that officers can get the help they need and the resources they need. A lot of our agencies out there are simply standalone. They have very few officers, City of Gresham being one of those. A very dear friend of mine went to high school and got hired together May 4th, 1987, Claudio Grandjean. He's in charge of the sex abuse response from Gresham PD. Without the coordinated effort that we have with other agencies and the multi-agency approach, we simply couldn't do this correctly. And that's really not the victim's fault. Crime knows no boundary. In our area, you can talk about Max all you want, you can talk about Rockwood, and you can talk about the city of Gresham and all of that, but every area is subject to this type of crime. It knows no limits and knows no boundaries, and victims should have the right to prosecution of those involved regardless of where they live. And so I look at the sex abuse response team as just a very important role and a very important team in the way that we resolve these conflicts. It is a dangerous world out there, no doubt. These poor victims have to relive every situation. Personally, for those of you that respond to emergencies or have in the past, you know there are images burned in your mind that you simply cannot get rid of. Every day, they're just that much away from coming back in the forefront of your mind, and that's all you'll think about. Now picture yourself as the victim, actually having to experience that. For me, I certainly hope that in talking to some of the members of the committee, I hope that we can move this bill. I think it shows a great opportunity here and also and makes us more than just about what Multnomah County is able to do or some of the other resources, and we actually get this bill put forward so the state of Oregon has a system-wide approach to sex abuse response teams. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions?
Thank you. Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time.
Okay, we're going to recess this bill in case Senator Edwards is able to get here, and we'll open it then. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 619. Mr. Honeycutt.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 619A provides the owner of property acquired by condemnation agreement with the right of repurchase to all or part of the property if the property is not used for a public purpose within 10 years, if the condemnation agreement fails to include provisions required to that effect, which specify a reasonable amount of time for a condemner to use or use within 10 years, or waiver of the right of repurchase. It applies prospectively and exempts Oregon's Department of Transportation projects, declares an emergency effective on passage. Current law provides original owners with this kind of right of repurchase for property that's acquired by condemnation, and this would apply it to voluntary condemnation agreements.
Co-chairs Krieger, Barker, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of Senate Bill 619, a bill that comes to you from the Senate on a 29-1 vote. What the bill does, current law authorizes a property owner whose property is condemned for some type of public use to repurchase that property if the condemning body doesn't put the property to a public use within a 10-year period. So at the end of 10, if your property is condemned, 10 years goes by and the condemning body isn't putting your property to a public use, you have the right as the property owner who was the subject of the condemnation lawsuit to repurchase that property under terms that are set out and with a process that's set out in existing statutes, and we're not trying to change any of that process at all. This bill doesn't do that. The problem with the current law is that the right to repurchase only applies if a judgment has been entered into the circuit court. The way the condemnation process works, condemning body, city, county, state, whatever, makes a determination that they want to condemn property. The city or the county will adopt an ordinance to that effect to authorize the condemnation, and then there's a negotiation period in which time the condemning body and the property owner enter into negotiations over a purchase price. If the parties can come up with an agreement, then they avoid a lawsuit. If there's no agreement that can be reached, usually the problem revolves around the purchase price. If there's no agreement, once the ordinance or resolution is adopted by the county or by the city or the county or whoever the condemning body is, then a lawsuit can be filed and the property owner becomes the defendant in the lawsuit. Under the current law, the right to repurchase only applies if the lawsuit's filed and judgment is ultimately entered. If the property owner and the city are able to, or the county are able to, reach an agreement short of filing a lawsuit, which is what I think we're trying to encourage folks in this position to do, then the right to repurchase doesn't apply. You have to actually go all the way through and get a judgment before the right to repurchase applies. So what this bill does is take that back a step and say, once the city or the county has enacted a resolution or ordinance that authorizes the condemnation, if during that period the property owner and the condemning body reach an agreement, save the need for everybody involved to get to have a lawsuit filed, then the right to repurchase applies if the property isn't used for a public use within 10 years. That's all the bill does. We made amendments over on the Senate side to remove transportation transportation projects to address ODOT's concern, and we also removed the retroactivity section of the bill over on the Senate side. So with that, I think we've addressed the concerns expressed over on that side, which is probably why the bill passed 29-1 over there. So I hope that the committee will move the bill out. It's a little bill, but it makes a pretty good change.
Committee members, any questions? Representative Juan.
I'm skimming through 35.385 here, and I just want to get an understanding. What's the repurchase price? Is it the then existing fair market value?
Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Wand, the purchase price, I believe, is the original purchase price with interest tacked on. I think the statute specifies a rate of interest that's tacked on to that. But this bill doesn't change any of that.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Any further questions? Ms. Torme?
Thank you. Mr. Honeycutt, so I can imagine that maybe a small town or city or somebody, some public agency, purchases a piece of property and they're holding it for a period of time, let's say 9 years, 10 years, 11 years. So the property is gaining value. It might be three times what it was purchased for, the value might be. So if the original property owner wanted to purchase that back, you're saying they would pay back the original purchase price, not the current value of the property?
Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Tomei, no. The existing law sets out the method for determining the purchase price, and I believe that the existing law starts with the original purchase price and then tacks on a statutory rate of interest. It's spelled out in current law, and this bill makes no effort to change that. Whatever the current law says as to the determination of the purchase price is unchanged by this bill. All this bill does is extend back to say that people, that property owners who have done what I think most normal property owners would do and made an effort to try and agree with the condemning body on a purchase price prior to getting sued and taking the case all the way through to judgment, have the same rights to repurchase as maybe a more recalcitrant property owner or a more recalcitrant local government who can't agree on a purchase price and then end up spending attorney's fees both at the government level and at the private citizen level and court time litigating over, you know, $50,000, $100,000, whatever on the purchase price.
If I may follow up, thank you. So maybe I'm not understanding you or you're not understanding my question. So say the property was sold for $100,000. 10 years later, it's worth $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So is that the original owner going to be able to buy it at $100,000 plus the interest, or is he going to buy it back at $1 million?
Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Tomei, the original property owner will be able to purchase that property, and I believe this is accurate. I'm not sure of the answer because this bill doesn't change this, but I believe that the answer is that the original property owner will be able to repurchase the property for the original purchase price plus a rate of interest that's set out in statute.
And this doesn't change that?
This doesn't change this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Okay. I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 619. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 619A to the floor with the due pass. Representative Barker has moved Senate Bill 619A to the floor with the due pass. Any discussion on the bill? Jose Juan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and I appreciate the line of questioning that Representative Tomei and I were working on, and it seems to me the way I kind of unpack this in my own head is that we want to make sure that when governments are condemning property, that they're doing so for a public purpose and that they're following through with that public purpose right away. And that's important, and it's clear that this bill does that, and it will encourage our local governments to be very responsible and careful about using condemnation power, which is proper and appropriate. So I'm a yes vote. Thank you.
Agreed. Yeah, this sounds like the answer to Caleb versus New Haven, which I like.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We condemned some property when I was on Happy Valley City Council to straighten a dangerous road, but Representative Tomei's questioning about the value going up, the value could go down, and the original property owner could be paying an inflated price for property that was theirs within that 10 years. So it goes both ways, if they wanted to buy it back.
Mr. Chair, this sounds like this bill has a great deal of measure. What am I trying to say? So, anyway, it sounds like a good bill. But I still have some questions about it. I will be voting no, but I may be voting yes on the floor.
Okay, thank you. Anything further? Call the roll.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Excused.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
No.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Woodman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye.
Senate Bill 619A loses the floor to do pass. Would anyone like to carry the bill? Okay. Okay. Representative Barker. Reopen from our recess we had on Senate Bill 557. So Senator Edwards can testify, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chris Edwards, State Senator in North Eugene, West Eugene, and Junction City. I'll be very brief with my testimony, as I really don't have a whole lot to add as to what the bill does or why we should have it that hasn't already been covered by previous speakers. And I've had the opportunity to speak with many members of the committee already about the bill. Senate Bill 5557 is the outcome of a lot of work that my staff has put in the interim during this past legislative interim on this issue. The issue first came to my attention when a constituent of mine contacted me and notified me about a situation where rape victims were, I mean, frankly, going to the emergency room and, you know, waiting 3 and 4 hours to see a doctor. And you know, the injustice in my mind of that, and in such a horrific situation and time, really kick-started my interest in this particular issue. And working with the Attorney General's Task Force on Sexual Assault, came up with the bill that is before you today and before this committee. You know what the bill does, so all I can say is that you know, we've put a lot of work into this. We've worked really hard with stakeholders all around the issue to get buy-off on it. And I really do believe that should we move forward with this type of policy, that you know, ultimately we will have better outcomes for victims of rape and sexual assault, higher rates of prosecution, and ultimately a better transition out of, you know, out of such a horrible time in one's life, should they be the victim of this type of crime. So that's really all that I have to say about the bill here today, and really do appreciate your consideration, Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger, and hope that you'll find it in yourself to move to work session on this post haste.
Any questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair, if I may. 35 or 40 years ago, when I was new in the police work, it truly depended on what officer got the call, what would happen to a rape victim, and how they were treated. And I've seen the improvement with the sexual assault teams when I worked up in Portland. And it's just day and night difference. And these victims certainly deserve the respect and good treatment. And I appreciate you bringing this bill forward.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yep. Close a public hearing on Senate Bill 557. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 740.
Chairs and members of the committee, first off, in your packets, you'll notice that the draft staff measure summary is inaccurate. It's a copy of the text of the previous bill, and they're passing out the correct SMS staff measure summary draft for this measure, Senate Bill 740. Thanks to Representative Wand for pointing that out to me before the meeting started today so I could hurry up and fix it and you had the proper draft in front of you. This measure requires a description of real property to include the street address, if there is one, for properties that are sold by the sheriff pursuant to a writ of execution. Right now, they only are required to contain the legal description.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the Judiciary Committee, thank you for having me here today. I am Anna Braun. I'm a legislative aide for Senator Przonski, and I'm here today to represent Martin Henner, who is not able to be here, but he's a constituent that asked Senator Przonski for this bill, and it's a very simple bill, but a very good idea. It requires that foreclosure notices have the street address as well as the legal description, and basically that's what the bill does. So if it's in a newspaper and it just doesn't refer to the legal description but also has the street address so everyone knows what piece of property we're talking about, and that's basically what the bill does. Thank you.
Any questions, committee?
Thank you.
close a public hearing on Senate Bill 740 and open a work session on Senate Bill 740.
Chair moves Senate Bill 740 to the floor with a due pass.
Co-Chair Barker moves Senate Bill 740 to the floor with a due pass. Any more discussion on the bill? Call the roll.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Accused.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative
Tomei.
Aye.
Representative
Wong. Aye.
Representative
Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hitt.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair
Garrett. Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Senate Bill 740 moves the floor to due pass. Anyone would like to carry the bill? Representative Tomei. Okay, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 68.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 68 is the measure that was comes from the Department of State Police. They reviewed their ORS Chapter 181, and this is a corrective and stylistic changes made in the revamp of that measure. The bill was heard on April 26th and May 18th briefly. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. We were only waiting because a conflict arose with Senate Bill 408, and amendments were prepared. Those are the dash ones to resolve the conflict.
And we have the dash ones.
We have the dash ones, and there's no revenue and no fiscal on the dash ones.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, move the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 68.
Chair Barker has moved the dash one amendments in Senate Bill 68. Any discussion on the amendments? If not, amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 68 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Chair Barker moves Senate Bill 68 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any other discussion on the bill? Call the roll.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Excused.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Yes.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative
Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair
Hitt.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye.
Senate Bill
68,
excuse me,
68. Yeah, 68 moves to the, as amended, moves to the floor
of the pass. You are also not here at state police. Yeah.
I'll carry the bill. Your amendments to
57.
You could restate this as the possible measure of introduction that's being carried over that was supposed to go into that.
Okay, the possible measure introduction of LC 440-4213 will be carried over till tomorrow from today. And we don't have the amendments for 592, which I mentioned we would not work, so we are done for the day.